This is HPR episode 2633 entitled, Elm, First Impressions. It is hosted by Tuku Toroto, and is about 30 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, my first impressions on Elm programming language.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Good morning, listeners of the Hacker Folk Radio. I'm Tuukka Turto, Tuturto, and you can call me Tuka if that's any easier. Today I'm going to talk to you about Elm. My first impressions on the language after playing around with it a little bit. So how did I get started with the Elm? I have been working with some Haskell code web project as a hobby and needed to make some client-side scripting, and I wanted to do something else than JavaScript and chose Elm because it looked interesting. Elm is a statically typed functional language compiled to JavaScript, so it means that you write your code in Elm and then you run a compiler, and that compiler turns the Elm code into the JavaScript code that you can include on the web page. It also checks that your types matches, like you cannot accidentally use strings instead of integers and things like that. So it took a little bit of fiddling to get things up and running with the YesOd, mainly because I didn't know better, but after I figured out how to include Elm scripts into YesOd site, it was pretty smooth sailing. And I must admit that I really, really, really like the Elm currently. It's really exciting language for me. So, Elm architecture. So the architecture of the programs you write in Elm, not the language architecture. So it's pretty set to the stone how you're supposed to structure your programs. I don't know any other ways to do that. But essentially, you have a event loop, and you have handful of functions that are related to that event loop. First is init for setting up things. That basically just returns you the state of the program, like this is the initial state, and it might run one or more commands. We'll get into those a little bit later, but those are, for example, if you are loading some JSON data from the web server, this is where you do it. That's what you do with the commands. And that state of the program, that's just a single type. Single instance of that type. I usually end up just being very unimaginative, call my model or my state as a model. So this is what the init does. Initial state, zero or more commands. Then there's a update. It's a function that takes a two parameters. It takes the current state, and it gets a message, and based on those, it creates a new model, a new state for you, and that's basically it. Oh, right. It also might again create few or more commands, and these messages that update handles, these can be results of commands, like if you send a HTTP GET to the server, eventually it will come back as a message of, hey, here's your data. So the upgrade function is basically a big case study. Like if the message is this, do this to the state. If message is this, do this to the state, and so on. And the last important part is the view. This is what is in charge of rendering things on the screen. And it's just a function that takes one parameter, current state of the program, and it's supposed to return you a HTML page or fragment. Here you render your stuff on the screen based on the state of the program. Or actually, you don't render it on the screen. You describe Elm that this is the HTML that I want to have, and Elm behind the scenes will take that HTML, convert it to what's on screen already, and update it only on the parts that needs to be updated. The whole screen doesn't get updated every time there's a single event. And fourth part that not on every program is subscribe. That is, for example, if you want to set up timers at the beginning of the programs. This is the stuff that, okay, subscribe, I create a timer like this and subscribe to that, and it will start creating events to you on an event base. And the init and the subscribe are run once at the start of the program, but the update and view are run constantly. Every time there something happens, every time the new message comes, update takes care of that. And every time update has run, Elm architecture will take care of that, the view will be run and it will display your stuff on the screen. So it's the thing that I liked about this is that it's so well organized. There's no accidentally updating the screen while you are modifying the state of the program, and you cannot modify state of the program when you are updating the screen. Everything is put neatly into boxes, and those boxes are labeled. So when you define those four functions, you can construct a Elm program. I don't remember what that function is called, but it's in every tutorial. So I mentioned commands earlier. So these are for things like HTTP requests, random numbers, geolocation, and such. So one of the ideas behind the Elm is that the data is immutable. You can't modify the data. You can only create a new data. So if you have a model, for example, you cannot modify that, but you can create a new model based on that existing one. Same thing with the you cannot accidentally somewhere in the program do something that has a effect on the, for example, it doesn't accidentally trigger HTTP request. You're very explicitly creating those commands at the update function, nowhere else. And when you create a command, Elm doesn't execute it yet. You're just saying that, hey, Elm, please do HTTP get to this address. And when the message comes, when the result comes back, wrap it into this message and give it to the update function. And Elm will take that command of yours and execute it behind the scenes. And at some point you will get message, but yourself aren't executing anything. You are just asking Elm to do that stuff for you. So I think all of the code you are writing in the Elm is really neat and simple because of this, because everything is like, these parameters come in, this data comes out. You may call other functions from your function, but those are again, this data comes in, this data comes out, very specifically typed. Nobody's going to trigger a HTTP GET, for example, or HTTP POST somewhere deep in your code. You can be sure that if you call this function, nothing else will happen, but you pass in the data and you get the answer back. And that makes the, at least in my opinion, programs easier to keep together and easier to understand what's going on. Okay, JSON decoding, encoding. This is something that I actually struggled initially, partly because of the whole the language is completely new to me, partly because I think that the Elm's default JSON parser is somewhat, it's not as good as it could be. But in the end, it ended up pretty nice. So in my case, the JSON is a boundary between JSON and the Elm. So on the server side, there's all those nice neat data structures modeling my domain, and then they get turned into the string that is cast over the internet. Elm receives that string, hopefully in a intact, and turns that string into a object. And vice versa, of course, when my Elm program sends something on the server, all those beautiful data structures get encoded into the string that is passed over the internet. And this is the part where I got quite a lot of errors and problems, because you don't have type safety. You have a string, and then you are doing your best to parse it, and the compiler can help you there somewhat, but compiler has no clue whatsoever about the structure of your string that you are parsing. Compiler has an idea about the code that is doing the parsing, either coding or encoding, but it has no idea what's in the string or what should be in the string. And I don't really know if it, in any sensible way, could even have that information. So if you talk about decoding first, the Elm's JSON parser is based on the combining parsers together. There's a bunch of simple parsers. Like, it knows how to take a string and turn that into the integer, or take a string and turn that to the string, or take a list of something and as a string presentation, list of something, and turn that into the real list of something. And those are, somebody said that they are like Legos. They have a really, those tiny parsers have a same interface. Everybody has the same interface, and you can combine them together. So if you are parsing an object, you are just saying that, create me an object of this type, and fetch from the JSON this field named this and parse it with this parser, and then you fetch this field named like this and parse it with this parser, and the whole thing wraps it as a Elm talks about encoders, so the whole thing gets into the encoder, and that encoder you can throw into a new decoder, of course. And the decoder you can use, it has the exact same interface as that humble take string return int. Now you have a decoder that take a JSON string and return your object. And then decode bunch of, you have a list of these in your JSON, you can just say that, okay, take a decode.list and combine that with that your specific parser, and now you have a parser that parses a list of your things. And you can has some logic there. If you have a JSON that is very complicated, very complex, you can have that things like, okay, try this parser. If it doesn't work, try this and try third one as the last one. So like you can have some logic there. It tries those three and uses the rest that succeed. But if nothing succeeds, the whole thing just fails. So the thing that is not so nice here is that it relies on the order of constructor parameters. So if you have an object that takes, say, 10 parameters, it has 10 fields, you have to pass those decoders onto that object in a correct order. Types will help you there to keep things not mixed up, but it's still less than ideal. I don't really know how to write it better. And like I said, Elm's standard or original JSON decoder is a bit of a not so nice. Like if you are passing a object that has two parameters, you are calling, I think it's called object two function. And if you are passing an object that has three parameters or three fields, you are calling object three, and so on up all the way up to the object eight. And that's not really good. But there's a couple libraries. One is JSON Extra and one is JSON Pipeline that are available at the Elm's package system, and those will make things a lot easier and a lot nicer. I personally am using JSON Extra because that's what I stumbled first, and only later on I learned about JSON Pipeline. Pipeline is maybe a little bit nicer interface. You don't have to repeat some things there that you have to repeat in the JSON Extra, but both of them are, on my knowledge, pretty good. I'll include a links into the show notes where to find this. Finally, encoding was much easier than decoding. Like on a retrospect, it isn't that surprising because you're just turning an object into string. Like you're basically you're just saying to the JSON.encode that create me a integer and put it in this value, this integer, and then it will turn that into JSON integer. Basically, it will just put a quotation marks around it. Same thing with the list, and same thing with the other JSON data types. And then you have the object that takes an array of tuples. First element of the tuple is a name of the field, and second one is the value. Second one is the parsing, the actual encoding part. So here you put, for example, encode int and your integer. Or again, if you have a complex thing, you can put your own encode. So again, you are building encoders for simple things and then combining those simple things to more complex things to have a big complex parsers that are relatively easy to maintain. I mentioned earlier that Elm's data structures are immutable, so you cannot modify them. You can just take our existing data structure and create a new one based on that. So with the numbers, it's easy. Like you are given one and you want to add something to that, you just say 1 plus object plus one, and you get two. But if you have hash tables or dictionaries or associative arrays, whatever you want to call them, that are basically just a key value pairs that you have a key and then you have a value. And if you want to work with those, then things can get bit more complicated. Reading is easy because if you have a object called ship, and then you know that's a record. Elm uses the record here. and you know that it's a record that has a name field in it, you can just say ship.name and you get the name out of. And if you know that the name object is again a record, you can say ship.name. Something else, maybe the first name. That doesn't really make sense in the case of ship, but you get the idea. So reading is easy, but if you want to modify things, then create new ones, then it might get a bit trickier with the records. The Elm has that thing that you can create a new record and replace values inside of that. You can create a new record based on the old one and replace some of the values. That is easy to do on the Elm. No problems there. But if you have a nested record structure and you want to, I think you have a, for example, you have a ship record, and inside of the ship record you have a engine record, and inside of the engine record you have a crankshaft record, and there you have some value that you want to change. For example, how fast it's spinning. I don't know. And normally, to change that, you would have to take that crankshaft record, replace the value of it, that specific value that you want. Now you have a new crankshaft record, and then you want to stuff that into the engine. So you need to construct a new engine record and replace your crankshaft there with that new value that you created. And then you have to take the ship and create a new ship based on the old, replacing the engine with that new engine that you created, that has that new crankshaft that you created. And this gets really tedious over time. But Elm has sort of kind of lenses, the setters rather. Lenses come, I think, I first encountered those on the Haskell side. Mm-hmm. On the Elm side, they are quite a bit easier, simple, because reading of the things is so easy. But, and true to be told, I never really got the lenses working that well on the Haskell side, but that's not here or there. But these are little helpers that are for modifying nested data structures, because you can write a lens that, in our example, modifies the engine, ship's engine, and nothing else. And then you can write a lens that modifies engine's crankshaft. And then you can write a lens that modifies crankshaft's whatever value, that rotation speed, for example. And these descriptions are just one lines. They are not complicated. They are just one lines. And these lenses you can then chain together to make a more complex lens and give it to a name, or you can just combine them when you need them without giving them to name. And then you can just take your ship and say that on this ship run this lens and stuff, change the value to this, and it will automatically destructure your whole ship engine crankshaft thingy, set that value on the crankshaft, assemble it together to a new engine. And to you, this is all happening in the behind the scenes. You don't have to worry about this. You just say that, please update my ship's this value. And you can also, if you want, you can also, there's another syntax that can be used to run a function to that value that you fetch from the down there and use that to replace it. So that makes editing those nested data structures much nicer. And there are a couple ones of these again. Please focus is what I ended up using. I like the name, like you have a really complex big thingy and you just say, hey, please focus on this thing here. So, and again, I will include a link into the show notes where to find this one. So that's basically what I have been playing with the Elm so far. I have been building a little spaceship designer just for fun, like where you can just pick what kind of classes you have, and then you start putting on the various components like bridge and sensors and motors and such, and then the program has some rules that you don't exceed the maximum weight, and you have all the needed parts and stuff like that. And it has been pretty pleasant. It's been a bit slow, but I think that's just because the Elm is a completely new language to me. So pretty much everything I need to ask from DuckDuckGo, like, hey, how do I do this? So summa summarum, what I like that the compiler will catch some errors. Like it's like a sort of guard railing there, keeping me in the correct track and not letting me to go into the funny places where you can add strings and integers together. And I think that it might be easier if you have a big project for new people come in, if you have a statically typed language like Elm, because the compiler will say that this place accepts this kind of input, and this place combines with some other stuff like this. It's like a sort of like a Legos, very specifically designed interfaces. You don't accidentally end up combining things incorrectly. Well, I mean, you can combine things incorrectly, but compiler will catch some of those incorrectness. Not all compiling Elm program is valid Elm, is not a bug-free Elm program, but every compiling Elm program probably is much, I don't know. I just like in this case that there's a compiler to help me to keep things on track. Which is funny because on the other hand, I really love how you can work on a dynamically typed languages like some Lisps and Python. They're also real nice. So maybe I just like pretty much every language, but for different reasons. I don't know. JSON parsing, encoding and decoding after the initial hurdles is pretty nice. Like you get your magical strings coming from the internet turned into a data structures in a way that hopefully catches some errors. And on the other hand, you can take your beautiful data structures and create a string and send that to the internet with some confidence. Documentation on the Elm is good. The official site has nice amount of examples, and the package repository seems to have decent documentation on, at least on the packages that I ended up using. What I miss sometimes there's some cases where I wish that the Elm would have type classes. This is a feature from the Haskell side, but you can usually work around that, and it's not that big thing. It's not that big deal that they aren't there. They are huge thing to implement. I think that's why they aren't in the Elm. I found some discussions online where they're talking about implementing those and sort of kind of saying that we look into this, but nothing has surfaced, and it's nothing big. It's just something that I miss sometimes. And what I really should learn is to how to debug properly and how to do testing of the Elm programs properly. I don't really know anything about that. I know that there's a bunch of testing libraries out there, but I just haven't had time to look into those and experiment with those. Same with the debugging. I used that age-old printing out data debugging. So when I have a piece of program that isn't working, I'm just printing out what's going in and what's going out and trying to figure out what's wrong with that. But that's a really nice thing about Elm, that because every function is just data in, data out. It's easier to think what's wrong with this, like why isn't this thing working. You don't have to go hunting all over the program, like is this flag set, or is this thingy mob in a state A or B. Everything is just this comes in, you do some processing, this comes out. That's nice and clean, and makes thinking about the program a little bit easier. But that's about it what I have to say about Elm currently. It's a really nice language. I heartily recommend you to have a look at it if you are doing some client-side scripting on a web and want to try out some different type of languages. Okay, talk to you next time. Cheers.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.